Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Stephen Hausman, your host and an assistant professor of history at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. My guest today is Dr. Karen Jones, a professor of environmental and cultural history and the director of the Center for the Study of Health, Science, and Environment at the University of Kent. Dr. Jones is the author of many books and articles on environmental history and on the history of the American West, including her latest, Calamity, The Many Lives of Calamity Jane, which came out with Yale University Press last year in 2020. Welcome to the New Books Network, Karen.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's really good to be here.
Why don't we begin, like we traditionally do here on the New Books Network, by just hearing about yourself. Tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you became interested in history, and especially how you became interested in the history of the American West.
Okay, well, I grew up in the west of England, not the west of the United States, which has a reputation as quite a laid-back place, a rural place. So I spent my formative years in a different but sort of similar West in some ways, and I always had an interest in history and geography. So I was sort of very much an outdoors person. I studied at the University of Warwick as an undergraduate, and then took a master's program at the University of Bristol, both in the UK. And it was during my master's program that I became particularly interested in frontier spaces, so North American frontier, but also Southern Africa. And those were the courses that really ignited my interest in thinking about the environmental politics and cultural politics of conquest and in the 19th century. And it was through that master's program that I went on to do a doctorate, which was centered on environmental history. So I got to Calamity Jane somewhat curiously by working on wolves, which does not sound like an obvious transition, but I wrote a doctoral thesis, which became my first book, Wolf Mountains, all about the dynamics of wolf eradication and reintroduction, restoration in national parks in the US and Canadian West, in Glacier, Yellowstone, Banff, and Jasper. So I was really, in that program, in the master's program, and in this doctoral project, I think my interests were very much focused upon thinking about environmental transformation and also the cultural environment of the West and what that meant symbolically and in folklore terms. And of course, the wolf has a pretty striking folkloric profile of its own, and I wandered as a early career researcher further into that world by thinking through hunting rituals and performance and writing on that particular engagement with the West between sport hunters and animals. And I guess it was there really that I encountered Calamity Jane most fully as an intriguing subject to study, because I'd heard about Calamity Jane. I mean, everybody's heard of Calamity Jane, right? You know, certainly as a figure. I mean, most people that I've certainly talked to in this project have assumed her to be a construction of Hollywood, you know, a fictitious character. But it was in this hunting project that I started to think about her as a figure who operated in a really masculine world and engaged in activities that were regarded as typically masculine pursuits. So in the hunting project, it was really thinking through her place in the sort of canon of frontiersmen. And she popped up in that project as one of a number of kind of transgressive women, if you like, who were involved in the practice and the memorialization of hunting in the US West. But she kind of only really appeared there as a minor character in this story of transgression, I suppose. And it was really through talking to my publisher and also just exploring that a little bit more in my teaching. You know, teaching on the American West for me has always been provided a great space for thinking imaginatively about the West. And I really do think that teaching and research go so well together, that the debates and conversations in the classroom are enlivened by, you know, looking at the most recent research in the area and equally feedback into that. So, you know, I taught Calamity Jane as a bastion of my 19th Century West course. And so she kind of came back into view in these different ways. And I guess in being asked to think about writing a new Western project, it just struck me that she was a character who had much to say about the 19th century experience, but also about how the West has been manufactured and repackaged and recycled for different generations since the time of its making, if you like. And so for me, it was her subversive qualities, the fact that she was operating in this male dominated world, but also the allure of exploring the iconography and the kind of the layers of enigma around her that seemed to make for a project that was rooted in history but also allowed me to explore all different kinds of source materials and you know, wander into various spaces in the North American cultural imagination.
Yeah, and you mentioned this work kind of emerging out of your earlier work on hunting and ritual and folklore surrounding wolves and hunting. And when you said that, it was very clarifying. I can very much see the kind of one-to-one line that you drew there. Perhaps kind of a not a straight line necessarily, but I can see the connection between those two ideas, between Calamity Jane and the mythos surrounding her and the performances surrounding her, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and what you're talking about with your earlier work on wolves. That's a very clear line to me.
Yeah, I think it's that kind of teasing out that the relationship between the material engagement between people and the world around us and that sort of textured, imaginative, sometimes fairly wonky way that we interpret the spaces that we move through, and you know, the other species and landscapes and other people who fall into that story.
Critical biographies such as this book are an interesting, and I've never written one, but seemingly very challenging genre to write in. Can you tell us a little bit about the process and the experience of researching and writing so much about a single individual, particularly an individual as, you know, historically elusive as Martha Jane Canary is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting one because I think I in the histories that I've read and the works that I've kind of been impressed with, and I've very much been somebody who has focused on, I suppose, ideas and liked scholarship that's taken creative and inventive directions. And so for me, the idea of writing a biography didn't immediately leap up as a cool idea, because I guess biographical work has, there are many great biographies, but it also is regarded by some people as a territory that's, you know, can be really traditional. It can be quite hagiographic and celebratory. You know, it can be quite dry. How do you really position the story of one individual within a broader context? And I think that is the challenge of sort of balancing the personal with the contextual. But I think there have been a fair number of biographies, both about characters in the American West, but also elsewhere, that really have reinvented the genre in helpful and interesting ways to kind of stray from that path of being sort of textual champions of whoever you're writing on, but to try to see the way in which individuals are threaded into their time and speak to their time. So I guess the first challenge is making a biography that speaks to now and pulls the genre into this more creative and inquiring and critical space. And then, in a practical sense, I think you don't have to like the person you're writing about necessarily. Although, you know, I think Martha Jane Canary is a pretty interesting character. You certainly have to be intrigued by them, you know, because you're encountering this person all the time. So there has to be something about their story that keeps you going back and wanting to find more. And I suppose that hopefully that comes through to the readers and thinking the same things are interesting to read about, that are interesting to write about. She was particularly challenging because the biographical trace that she leaves behind is so fragmentary on one level, but also on another level so rich and extensive. So, you know, her own it's not as though we have all these memoirs and this huge kind of archive of materials that's left behind to sift through from herself. You know, many biographers are writing with subjects who've consciously and deliberately left the trail for the historian to follow, but she's not one of those people. So that made it tricky. But I think what really enlivened the project for me is the way in which, although she didn't leave a great deal of material behind, you know, by all accounts she was probably illiterate, for one thing. So many people were writing about her in her lifetime, and then subsequently, you know, there's this massive corpus of material to draw from. So it then becomes an issue of not having not enough stuff, but having too much stuff. I think I was helped in this project to some degree by the biographers who've looked at her before, and there aren't many of them, it must be said. But I think James McLeod's biography was particularly instructive because, you know, he did that job of meticulously finding all the tiny facts about her life and seeking to corroborate or not their veracity so well. It enabled me to step to the side of that of age-old question, you know, did she do this, did she not do that? And that for me was it was more interesting to focus not on the truth or the fiction and sifting all the evidence into one or the other, but to look at how those ran in together and created this cultural cocktail that allowed her to remain as such a critical figure in frontier mythology for so long. And I think that for me, that made for a more interesting subject to work on, to track that choreography rather than get into the business of proving and disproving things, because that I think that's in many cases that's quite difficult to say when you're dealing with somebody whose biographical trace is so fragmented, but about whom so many people have written kind of contested stories. I mean, the other thing to note is that you know the American West has such a rich archival trace. This one of the lovely things about this project was the small regional archives, which have boxes of material and have, you know, all kinds of interesting sources that spoke to this project, and that was great, being able to focus on that really quite, I suppose, traditional historical archival work for the 19th century stuff, but then to come forward into the 20th century and be opened up to this sort of popular culture avalanche of things that could be from wherever and you know, go from you know, Raisin Bran free toys in the 1950s to you know, Muppet Show costumes in the 70s, and you know, so it was nice to have that variety. And I you know, I never got bored of her, which really gives a sense, I think, about the interesting nature of her life and times, and you know, the rich cultural afterlife that continues to swirl around her.
Yeah, and I thought that was one of the more most compelling parts of the book, was how you don't really silo out the mythology from the, like, fact, you know, kind of scare quotes around both of those words, right? Because yeah, the way I read it is that you're making the point to an extent here that, you know, the mythos around her is just as much a part of who Calamity Jane is to us today as the reality. And so, as you said a second ago, it's a bit of a fool's errand and kind of misses the point to try to do that sort of debunking work. And that's not to say that you shy away from the truth of her story when you can access it, but you know, you'll also say, and this is what this particular biographer said, and this is what this particular myth or you know, possibly not exactly accurate story said about her. And I really appreciated how all of those threads were woven throughout the story. I thought that was really, it was unique, and it made for an interesting read.
Thank you. Oh, I'm really glad you liked it. I remember one of the kind of historiographical nuggets that has always stayed with me when you're looking at the theory of history and such like was cultural historian Arthur Marwick talking about myth and history and the fact that, you know, it doesn't matter whether myth is a falsehood or not, it's all about what power it has. And you know, I think in the 21st century we're palpably and probably sometimes disturbingly made aware of how true that is. And I guess that, again, that connection between the 19th century and the now shows that those sorts of threads of perception of reality are, you know, are ever present.
Well, let's get into Jane's life a bit. And why don't we, I mean, perhaps it goes without saying, but let's begin at the start. What do we know about Calamity Jane's early life? And what is, where do the facts sort of blend into the myth that we're talking about here in her early life?
Sure. So she's usually quoted as being born on one of two dates. So it's always May the 1st, and it's either 1852 or 1856. And these two dates kind of vie for the sort of truthfulness in the historical record. The working backwards, the census material that was discovered by a historian in the 1940s suggests that she was born in 1856 to Robert and Charlotte Cannery in Missouri. They were part of a family who'd moved successively from Virginia to Ohio and were recent settlers in Missouri. And this is, so we see Jane first in this population census where she's a young girl, and working backwards from that document, we can hazard that she was born probably in 1856. We don't know a great deal about her early life, because what happened in her story is that, of course, once she became notorious, then her early commentators and early biographers dragged the story back and tried to find people who knew her as a child. And of course, they're filtering their memories through the experience of the Calamity Jane, of the sort of her popular profile by that time. So there are tales of her being a kind of a feral child, and because she's given a backstory to substantiate her later reputation in this sort of gossip culture, I suppose we would call it. So beyond that, we don't really know a great deal about her. We know that she was the oldest of six children, and that her family then made the decision, or her father made the decision, to move from Missouri to the American West, to the mineral lands of Montana, to Virginia City. And this was sometime in the early 1860s. We know this because her next record, or next important record, is turning up on the doorstep of a local figure in December 1864, three young girls looking fairly dishevelled in the snow, asking for poor relief, asking for assistance, and this was in Virginia City. So she's, as many, many people did, she's part of that demographic movement which makes successive jumps to what they hoped would be prosperous farming land in the Midwest, and then gets captivated by the mineral fever and moves to Montana, where we find her as a youth. Both of her parents die in the 1860s as well, leaving her orphaned, and it's in this kind of context that she learns to live hand to mouth and take on different jobs and is, you know, living on the margins of this fluid frontier society trying to make ends meet. And there, you know, there are conflicting stories about what happens to her and where she goes, what happens to her parents, conflicting stories about who her parents were as well. So, you know, she's right from the very beginning, the idea of specific information and accurate information about her is not there. There's just claim and counterclaim and dates and places and people flying around all over the place.
And in the 1870s, Jane has several experiences, some verifiable, some we could say somewhat less verifiable, that would come to define her, for better or for worse, as a Western icon. So how did Jane, for instance, arrive in the Black Hills? What did she do there and really across the American West during the 1880s and 1870s that, like I said, would come to define her as this kind of iconic figure?
Sure. So she... from this point in Virginia City, she kind of pops up in various places, mining towns, railroad towns, ad hoc settlements. And she's located in the Black Hills in 1875. That's where we find the first photograph of her. She's pictured lounging on a rock. She's wearing men's clothes. So that, you know, already all the kind of critical ingredients of her legend are in place, that she's in this, you know, rugged frontier space. She's photographed with a photographer traveling with the army, and she's wearing male attire. So we know that she's traveling with, you know, she's moving in these different frontier spaces, and then she finds herself traveling with the army in the mid-1870s. She's recorded as part of the Newton-Jenny expedition, traveling with General Crook's entourage in 1876. So she becomes a fixture of that military culture. And people start talking about her because she's interesting and curious and unusual because of her dress. And, you know, this is the time period where she begins to tell stories, or she sort of backdates in later years stories to this time where she talks of scouting for Custer, indulging in all kinds of heroic exploits, saving a captain from ambush, which is how she gets the name Calamity Jane, heroine of the plains, for saving him. And again, this is all mired in folklore and disputed by people along the way. So she emerges as this this intriguing, unusual figure, and becomes a part of military chatter. She appears in Jack Crawford's poetry. She's talked about a lot. So she becomes a subject of conversation for the military in the 1870s period, in the kind of the middle part of that decade. What we know is that she was never on the army payroll. She was certainly spotted travelling with the army. Most likely she was doing freighting. She was cooking what they called a camp follower, possibly a prostitute, doing laundry. Again, all of those hand-to-mouth jobs where she can, trying to make ends meet.
And you mentioned that one of the things that makes Jane notable to other people in the American West early on, and indeed something that she's still well known for today, it's part of her legend and her status as this Western icon, was for wearing men's clothing. Can you talk a little bit about the dynamics of gender and indeed gender performance in the West, and what Jane's story tells us about the possibilities and indeed the limits of gender expression at the end of the 19th century in the United States?
Sure, sure. And I think actually this is one of the areas where you know, I was really, really persuaded in writing this book that there's a much bigger story here, much bigger story that's out there for historians of gender to really explore and deconstruct and excavate in important and stimulating ways. One of the interesting things to me was coming across so many references to women who were passing as men in the gold fields. There are, you know, some great testimonials about women being barred from claims because, you know, there were so many women passing as men. Comments about Horace Greeley travelling across country and talking about the fine chap that he spent time talking to for the conductor to turn around later in the journey and point out that the fine chap was actually a woman. I just think there's a real rich and interesting historical story to be about which we know fragments, we know about particular individuals, but I think there's much more to be said. And you know, Calamity Jane has been seen by some as a, if you like, as an unrepresentative character in the West, that, you know, she doesn't speak to the everyday lives of women really, because she's an exception, she's an oddity. And actually in working on this project, I was increasingly convinced that her unorthodoxies and her the way in which she pushes back against some of the normative assumptions about gender and identity in the West, you know, maybe she's not actually that unrepresentative in many ways, because certainly we know that women passed as men for all kinds of reasons to take advantage of economic opportunity, like in the case of the miners I mentioned before, to escape abusive relationships, to travel clandestinely, to get away from people as disguise then, also to inhabit alternative gender identities or sexual orientation. You know, so the West is a more fluid and a more open space for people to reinvent themselves, if you like. And of course, you know, it's certainly true to say that in terms of security, it was much safer for women to travel disguised as men than to travel as women in these years. So, you know, the motivations for passing are many and have, you know, the whole spectrum of different rationales behind them. And I think, you know, Calamity Jane's story, Martha Canary's story, speaks to a few of those, but by no means all of them. But she's a good window into a world which was marked, yeah, it was marked by opportunity in the sense that as a, you know, a woman travelling on your own in the 19th century West, if you disguise as a man, you're immediately kind of invisible in a way that means you can travel freely, claim, you know, various economic and political advantages which are reserved only for men in those times. But there are also significant constraints on the this as well, in the sense that, just to look at her story, she remains a marginal character through most of her life. She finds a sort of a comfort and an ease travelling in homosocial worlds at times, but she's also regarded as an oddity, as a curiosity, as a kind of a freak in many ways. I mean, I make that comparison in the book about her performance on stage and the other performers who were also exhibiting their bodies at the same time in the late 19th century. And so I think if you look at some of the laws and statutes that are passed and some of the treatment of the characters we know who were living out alternative gender identities, passing as men in those years, you know, they came in for pretty critical treatment and, you know, found life to be challenging and complicated. So, yeah, I think it's very true to say that this is a story about possibility and firm limits. And of course, I think things change and ideas about gender and kind of respectability become more sort of firm in their binaries the more, you know, as time goes on. So as some of these communities are settled and infrastructures are created, you know, the codes of normal cultural what equates to being normal in the sort of cultural architecture also becomes more concretely defined and more monolithically defined as her story continues. So, you know, she's regarded as a curiosity, but then, you know, people then start to become more critical of her, particularly in her later years. So yeah, I think it's a really important and timely project, I think, that really deserves more scrutiny by historians and particularly historians with a sophisticated understanding of sort of gender and cultural parameters.
Yeah, and another thing that I found that the book did really well was you know, you kind of point out that for a long time in the historiography of Calamity Jane, you know, writers and scholars they would talk about Martha Cannery, you know, wearing men's buckskin pants, for instance, and they would either treat it kind of as a curiosity or something that wasn't really central to the story. And you say, no, there's something here. There's something that's really worth paying attention to in the performance that Jane is putting on here. And I appreciated that. I thought that was I understood what you were going for. I felt
it's funny, you know, because there are so many things that change about how she's presented, but that's the one thing that doesn't change. You know, and so there's sort of a firmament in that costume that I think is really meaningful.
So you alluded to this a moment ago, but in the 1880s and 1890s, Calamity Jane really, you know, she becomes Calamity Jane in a new way. She becomes more legitimately famous as, you know, really a worldwide figure during these decades. How does this happen? How does she go from being sort of, you know, somewhat of, I think the term you use is a curiosity in camps and in army, you know, like scouting units and things, to becoming really, you know, an early American celebrity? Tell us about the early days of Jane as a Western celebrity and how she reacted to this newfound status.
Sure. Well, look, often people attribute her sort of explosion on the national stage, if you like, as the result of her appearance in dime novels. And she does. She stars. She's written into dime novels as a figure. Again, a kind of a curious heroine. From the late 1870s, she is especially important as the sidekick to Deadwood Dick in Edward Wheeler's novels. So she appears in about 22 of those, which are it surprises me how popular these pulp fictions were, because maybe it's just me, but I find them really hard to read. And they're quite confusing, and the plots twist and turn, and then you know, she'll be killed off, but then she won't be killed off. And, you know, there are no plot limits in the dime novel, which, you know, it's quite sort of a postmodern medium, I suppose, for that reason. But she certainly gets a national airing because of this genre, which is massively popular in the urban industrial East from the 1860s. And Tales of the West are probably one of the most important staples of dime novel literature. So this is important, I think, in sort of fomenting her as a national star, even an international star. Where I think the stepping point comes, though, from the camp stories in the military world to the dime novel is there's a whole chatter in the regional press and newspapers and some you know, early literature as well, that keeps picking up on her story. She seems like a go-to character if there's a slow news day, or hey, you know, Calamity Jane has rocked up in town. What's she going to do now? Is she going to, you know, get drunk and cause trouble? Is she going to make a lot of noise? Is she going to, you know, shoot off her guns? She's, you know, she's a really recognizable figure and a sort of a symbol of that unruly Westernness for and just kind of gold for the regional press, because, you know, she's sort of semi-tragic but semi-heroic, and, you know, and certainly not a run-of-the-mill character. So I think this world of regional press plays an important point. And certainly she, but it's, you know, that within the context of the dime novel, then there's a sort of an exchange between these different versions of her through the 1880s, which she plays on, and she tries to make the most of this growing celebrity by, you know, telling her stories if people buy her a drink at the bar. And, you know, she in a sense, I think, through her whole life, she's performed this role as she's travelling through the real West. And so it's not too much of a step for her to get onto a stage and do the same thing when she's invited to travel as part of a dime museum, so sort of a live-action version of the dime novel in the mid 1890s and 1896. So she's, you know, she's trying to make the most of this celebrity status. And it, you know, it provides some money, but it's not a very sustainable way of making a living. And of course, she's, you know, she's had this hand to mouth existence. She's got a you know, a significant developing alcohol problem. She's not, you know, a rootless person, and you know, it's hard to keep all of these balls in the air and make everything work for her. So and you know, I think the different the paths of celebrity, you know, for instance, when they require a, you know, the performance requires a much more rigid choreography on the stage compared to wandering around in an impromptu way. And I think maybe that doesn't fit her character profile very well. But I think she is an interesting figure because of the way she is trying to trade on her story and selling photographs of herself in Yellowstone and going on the stage and giving interviews with journalists to try to kind of put her side of things. And the fact that so much of this doesn't always match up, I just think makes it all the more fascinating.
And you mentioned Jane as a bit of a tragic character, or a tragic, you know, person, we could say, a few minutes ago. And indeed, Martha Jane Canary dies fairly young at the age of 47 in 1903. What was the end of her life like? And why was she rather famously buried next to Wild Bill Hickok, a man who, by all accounts, she only knew for a couple months, about 20 years earlier?
So, yeah, I think the last months of her life really show us the flip side of this celebrity story. You know, this is a figure who's whose body has been ravaged by drinking too much, by living a really hard life, by just basically being transient for the whole of her existence, pretty much. And she, she's basically physically broken by the age of 47, and dies ultimately as a result of alcohol abuse. So she really points to the really tough existence for for a whole bunch of people in the 19th century American West, but particularly for those who are operating outside of those normative cultural boundaries. You know, she dies young, and she dies in poverty. And the fact she ends up in Mount Moriah in Deadwood next to Wild Bill is just another really bizarre twist in her mythological story. Because she rides into Deadwood in 1876 as part of Hickok's entourage, and they sort of fan the fires of each other's celebrity. And hang out for a couple of months until he's killed, which kind of puts an end to that. But we don't really know why she ends up being buried next to him, but the suggestion is that the town boosters, on one hand, they thought it would be a neat tourist attraction to have these two great Western heroes buried side by side, you know, because by that point, this is a town with, that's stepping away from its frontier reputation to forge a more sort of established and safe 20th century prosperous existence, and this throwback to the wild days of old, you know, this presents the opportunity to entice tourists in with this dual hit of celebrity celebrity tourism. Certainly, very, very, very much towards the end of her life, Martha Canary does make the odd comment about having a relationship with Wild Bill, which, again, there's no evidence that this was actually the case. But she sort of throws this stuff out there, I think, to see if maybe to see what lands and what works as a good media nugget. And so that people start picking up on that story. But it is, you know, it's a real indication of that sense of the West being a physical space, but a space that's in the throes of its own self-invention just at the same time. You know, the gap between history and sort of commemoration and spectacular commemoration and invention is you know, is wafer thin in temporal terms.
And then for several decades after her death in 1903, Hollywood regularly placed Jane at the center of Westerns. Indeed, she's a sort of a regular figure in the genre's heyday in its early days of the kind of classic Westerns, as well as she pops up in some more atypical roles, too. So how did the mid-20th century film industry add to and or, you know, in some cases, play upon Calamity Jane's mythology?
So she's as a Hollywood character, she's interesting, I think, because she doesn't really have much of a trace in the early years of film, but certainly in the mid-century with The Plainsman and, of course, with Doris Day's Calamity Jane. So Jean Arthur plays her in The Plainsman, and then Doris Day famously in the 1953 musical. These two films are probably her most important outings, and they're both significant for, again, she's buckskin costumed as per usual, but she's, and particularly in the 1953 musical, she's, her character is softened and feminized, and you know, she's very much playing foil to the lead characters who are men, and so she's, you know, she's been tamed for the screen in some ways. The more complicated and interesting parts of her story are ironed out by celluloid. So she's, you know, presenting a story in the end about containment. And of course, you know, there are lots of alternative readings, particularly of the 1953 musical, because of the relationship between the two lead female characters, particularly, and the nature of their relationship, romantic or otherwise. So there's a sort of bubbling under intriguing tale there. But certainly on the sort of the mainstream presentation, it's, you know, the taming of Calamity Jane. Calamity Jane settles down in an overally sort of tamed West, and she puts away the buckskin. But even from the start, you know, she's Doris Day is fresh faced. You wouldn't mistake her for a man. She is, you know, worlds away from the historical Calamity, who's known as quite a stout figure, quite an imposing figure, quite tall. You know, Doris Day's Calamity is she's got this sort of 1950s glow around her, and she doesn't drink alcohol, and you know, everything apparently at least resolves wonderfully at the end with her settling down. So I guess what Hollywood does is they look to find a historical image that has a bit of an edge to it and has a bit of a pluckiness to it, but ultimately fits with a story of conformity that matches the mid-century moral landscape.
In the book comes with a wonderful photo insert section, and one of the captions for, I think it's the last photo in that section, which is a screenshot of David Milch's HBO Deadwood series from the early 21st century. And the caption that you wrote for that is something along the lines of Robin Wiegert as a gritty Calamity Jane for the 21st century or something like that. And I really like that caption because I think it gets at an interesting point, which is that every era kind of remakes Calamity Jane to suit their own desires and needs and interests and political and social predilections, I guess. And that one line kind of stuck with me, that Calamity Jane is this sort of recurring figure in American history and storytelling for that very reason. And you talking about Doris Day's Calamity Jane in the 1950s was sort of a reminder of that for me as well.
Mm. And yeah, you know, you compare the Calamity Jane of Milch's Deadwood to the 1953 musical. It's a pretty contrasting image, and it just shows the malleability, I think, of the frontier story more generally, perhaps, and the way that the West has been manufactured and recast for different audiences. But I think, you know, Calamity Jane is such a great example of that in terms of the, you know, the story of an individual, the mythology of an individual. And I think she's particularly interesting in that regard because, you know, most of the tales of Western heroes, even the recycling Western heroes, has tended to be the recycling of male figures. So aside from probably Annie Oakley, who's sometimes confused with Calamity Jane, or that they sort of become an all-purpose frontier firearms heroine, apart from her, you know, there aren't really any other obvious contenders who've got that longevity and that richly layered folklore that actually is probably more telling and worth delving into than some of the other hero figures about which so much more is being written and broadcast. And I think that the 21st century or late 20th century and 21st century profile of her is particularly striking for the way in which she becomes a figure of choice for female playwrights who are looking to tell stories about feminism and sort of struggle and the sort of boundaries of gender containment and sexual politics and all sorts of things. So I was, you know, really struck by the amount of sort of creative and very poignant work that's been produced recently.
If there is, and I always hesitate to ask this question, or maybe it's better to say that I find that my guests, they kind of bristle at this question a little bit because it can be a difficult one. But if there's one thing that you hope readers come away from your book understanding or thinking about, what might that be? If there's one sort of overarching theme or message, what do you hope that your readers understand about Calamity Jane and about the story that you tell here?
Okay, well, I'm sort of torn between two, so I'm gonna throw both of them out there.
Sounds good.
So the first one I think is that it has her tale is it shows the heroism of the everyday, especially for people who were operating outside of the normative confines of life, and. Yeah, that resilience and struggle.
Yeah, I've been excited to cover this book since I first heard about it. So it was a pleasure to have you on. Dr. Karen Jones is a professor of environmental and cultural history at the University of Kent in Canterbury. Her latest book is Calamity, The Many Lives of Calamity Jane, which came out in 2020 from Yale University Press. Thank you once again so much for joining me today, Karen.